Sirens, machine gun nests, and a troop barracks were also at the ready. And now the commandos were going to break into it. Standing at the edge of the road, they were mesmerized by their first sight of Vemork. They did not need the bright of day to know its legion of defenses. They had studied scores of reconnaissance photographs, read reams of intelligence, memorized blueprints, and practiced setting their explosive charges dozens of times on a dummy model of the target. Each man could navigate every path, corridor, and stairwell of the plant in his mind's eye. They were not the first to try to blow up Vemork. Many had already died in the attempt. While war raged across Europe, Russia, North Africa, and in the Pacific, while battalions of tanks, squadrons of bombers, fleets of submarines and destroyers, and millions of soldiers faced off against each other in a global conflict, it was this plant, hidden away deep in the rugged Norwegian wilds, that Allied leaders believed lay on the thin line separating victory and defeat. For all their intricate knowledge of Vemork, the Nine were still not exactly sure how this target could possibly be of such value. They had been told that the plant produced something called heavy water, and that with this mysterious substance the Nazis might be able to blow up a good part of London. The saboteurs assumed this was an exaggeration to ensure their full commitment to the job. And they were committed, no matter the price, which would likely include their own lives. From the start, they had known that the odds of their survival were long. They might get inside the plant and complete their mission, but getting out and away would be another story. If necessary, they would try to fight their way out, but escape was unlikely. Resolved not to be captured alive, each of them carried a cyanide pill encased in rubber, stashed in a lapel or waistband. There were nerves about the operation for sure, but a sense of fatalism prevailed. For many months now, they had been away from their homes, training, planning, and preparing. Now, at least, they were about to act. If they died, if they went west, as many in their special company already had in other operations, so be it. At least they would have had their chance to fight. In a war such as this one, most expected to die, sooner or later. Back in England, the mastermind of the operation, Leif Tronstad, was awaiting news of the operation. Before the commandos left for their mission, he had promised them that their feats would be remembered for 100 years. But none of the men were there for history. If you went to the heart of the question, none of them were there for heavy water or for London. They had seen their country invaded by the Germans, their friends killed and humiliated, their families starved, their rights curtailed. They were there for Norway, for the freedom of its lands and people from Nazi rule. Their moment now at hand, the saboteurs refastened their skis and started down the road through the darkness. Part 1. Chapter 1. The Water. On February 14, 1940, Jacques Allier, a middle-aged, nattily-dressed banker, hurried through the doors of the Hotel Majestic on Rue Lapeyrouse. Situated near the Arc de Triomphe, the landmark hotel had welcomed everyone from diplomats attending the Versailles Peace Talks in 1919 to the influx of artists who made the City of Light famous in the decade that followed. Now with all of France braced for a German invasion, likely to begin with a thrust through Belgium, and Paris largely evacuated, a shell of its former self, conversation at the hotel was once again all about war. Allier crossed the lobby. He was not there on bank business, but rather as an agent of the Douzième Bureau, the French internal spy agency. Raoul Daughtry, the Minister of Armaments, and physicist Frédéric Joliot-Curie were waiting for him, and their discussion involved the waging of a very different kind of war. Joliot-Curie, who with his wife Irène had won the Nobel Prize for the discovery that stable elements could be made radioactive by artificial or induced methods, explained to Allier that he was now in the